Tonight on Arena, Conor O'Brien of Villagers gives us some euphoria in his new song, The First Day, and John McGregor gives us some derring do in the Antarctic in his new novel. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Conor O'Brien, also known as Villagers, has a string of accolades under his belt, including 2 Ivor Novello Awards, 2 Mercury Prize nominations, and is a previous winner of the Choice Music Prize. Conor spent a large part of 2020 in his home studio putting the finishing touches to his 5th album, Fever Dreams. He's just released a single, The First Day, from that upcoming album, and I'm delighted to say he joins me now to tell me more. This has happened so many times with things that are written and coming out around about now, Conor. It was all done before COVID, before lockdown, all of those things, yet the themes across the album seem to come directly out of COVID in some way.
That definitely wasn't meant to happen, but I guess as I was writing it, it sort of emboldened me to keep going down that avenue of escapism and trying to feel like you're sort of maybe somewhere that's a little bit richer than the place you physically are right now, whether it's like, you know, stuck in the, you know, 5 kilometers, or if it's in your brain, you know. So it's a weird one, that.
Yeah, it is very odd how something that you could be doing before all of the difficulty speaks directly to it, or maybe it's us that imposes that on it. But escapism is certainly a theme that's there. Was there something, you know, were you trying to push barriers, push boundaries and go into kind of new areas musically?
Yeah, I think I always am. I think for me, the albums are kind of just the result of that process, you know, and trying to kind of keep pushing yourself and making yourself a little bit more comfortable. And this one was just was the same, really. But it was with a full band, and it was quite a sort of social kind of human experience this time, which really helped. The last day of the band recording was the very first day of lockdown, so everything was all recorded just in time for me to mess around with it and just make it weirder and weirder.
And I think to a large extent what we get on the album, yeah, I'm sure you were doing playing around with mixes and things like that, but you were pretty much going for, in the recording process, for a live feel. You were recording with the full band and putting it all down at the same time, and getting that performance aspect was very much to the fore.
Definitely, yeah. I think it was just my continuing obsession with Duke Ellington. I just wanted to capture musicians that I really trusted in a room, and also try and bring stuff that was a little bit less finished to the band and see what happened with it, which is always a bit scary, because when you're trying to make stuff, you're really living inside that stuff, you know. But this, yeah, it kind of worked for me this time, I think.
The First Day is the single that I'm going to play now, inspired by a trip to another love story, the festival in County Meath. What happened, and how quickly did the song start to take form in your mind?
Well, I can't tell you what happened, but it was just a really inspiring weekend. And I just remember getting back from it and instantly trying to get some music down to continue the vibes in my head a little bit. But it started out as a bit more of an electronic kind of techno-y thing, which was terrible. And then it eventually got some words and became this much more euphoric, kind of ecstatic song, which I'm really happy about.
Yeah, well, let's have a listen then to the First Day single from Villagers and the new album Fever Dreams. It's like falling in love on the first day of the rest of your life. There you go, The First Day, which is a single from the upcoming album Fever Dreams from Villagers, and Conor O'Brien speaking with me this evening. Feels like sunshine, feels like floating on the essence of a dream, feels like falling in love on the first day of the rest of your life. Can you really not tell me what happened at another Love Story Festival in County Meath, Connor?
It all happened.
Floating on the essence of it. Are you still floating on the essence of that dream then?
Every day since. It's all true. I never lie. Yeah, it's just like the simplicity, you know, joy and beauty. And I also wanted to kind of reclaim the word snowflake, which is in the song. That was kind of an important thing for me.
Yeah, I noticed that because initially I had to say, it feels like snowflake and it feels like sunshine. The two things almost been in some ways the same type of thing. But snowflakes falling in your face, that's pretty nice too. I presume that didn't happen in County Meath at the...
No, but it's almost happening today. It's fucking freezing today.
it certainly is that. Does that song fit into this whole idea of Nevermind chorus verse, let's just do chorus, another chorus?
It kind of does, yeah. I really like the idea, especially on this album, of making pop songs, pop music, and sort of not being afraid of that and not being afraid of just trying to write something that might be just really enjoyable as a groove, you know, and something that people can kind of dive into on a sort of superficial level maybe, but if they want to go any deeper they can, you know, and it's kind of all there waiting for them.
Yeah, and the brass in that really gives you this, you know, it's a great uplifting feel as that brass starts to really ring out towards the end of the song. But I'm wondering about that idea, is, you know, on a superficial level it is just you know, pure euphoria and pure joy, but I noticed that there is a video that was going alongside, and this was playing on the Late Late Show on some of the screens in the background last weekend.
Yeah.
A dance aspect to it. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah, the video, it was made by a guy called Daniel Brereton, who I've been a huge fan of for quite a few years. He did a video by electronic artist called Errol Alkin, which is one of my favourite music videos ever. And sometimes I think music videos can be a little, just a little problematic for me, because it feels like they can be just put on at the end of the process, you know. But he kind of makes his own art and really connects to the music. And that one, I just let him go. That he sent back this idea for the song, which just reflected the essence, you know, and the ethos of the music. And the first time I saw it, but I just fell in love with it. It was a really, really lovely moment.
Were you, like the rest of us, glued to the screen for Normal People when it was on last year?
It was. And
your song, of course, Everything I Am Is Yours, was in the midst of all of that. What's that like? I often think for the songwriter, because that song existed long before Normal People existed. What's it like when a song takes on a new life like that?
Yeah, that was interesting, because it was quite an old song in my mind, and I'd actually forgotten that we had, you know, agreed to it. And when I saw the show, I was pleasantly surprised that I loved it. You know, it was really, really great show. And obviously it was in the midst of, I think, was it the first lockdown, the second lockdown?
Yeah, I think it was part of why there was one joy that we had to keep going to our screens for.
That was a bit of escapism. And it just, I just felt it really tied in really nicely with because I thought the characters were really brilliant in that, and they were really well acted, and the script was gorgeous. So it was a real privilege to have my music play at the end of it.
And mind you were kind of, I think, post-pandemic, and during that period you were avoiding screens to a large extent. Were you taking the thumbs away from the phone, the hands off the keyboard, and getting back to a more basic form of creative entertainment?
Not at that point, but I think a bit later. I think at that point I was just doing what I could to try and figure out what the hell was going on. I kind of got into a mode later on of just putting the screens down and getting back into reading actual long form things, and, you know, getting your kind of mental capacities working again. And it was the best thing I'd ever done, because I just, you know, it makes you realize that a lot of the stuff you're seeing every single day is just... it's just one form of reality, and there's you know, literature and books and poetry is a never-ending well of history that you can always dive into. So that was a positive thing that came out of the pandemic for me.
And you're obviously looking forward enormously and being very hopeful and positive. Live show scheduled for the end of the year. And I think the first of the Vicar Street shows already sold out.
Yeah, that was crazy. Can't believe it. Sold out in 3 hours, which blew my mind. So fingers and toes crossed that we can do it. And yeah, I would absolutely love to get back touring again. It's I'm thinking about it every single day. So
here's hoping indeed. And there are lots of people who would love to see you and lots of other people getting back to live performance as well. Thanks for speaking to us this evening, Conor.
Thanks, Sean. Thanks for having me.
That's Conor O'Brien and Villager's album Fever Dreams. It will be out in August. Tickets for live dates are available now. You can find out full details on wearevillagers.com. John McGregor's fiction tends to illuminate the extraordinary in everyday life. From his 2002 debut, If Nobody Speaks of Remarkable Things, to Reservoir Tapes, his series of stories from 2018. His fifth novel, Lean, Fall, Stand, begins in a deadly storm in Antarctica, where three scientists are suddenly cut off from one another with tragic consequences. And John McGregor joins me this evening from Nottingham. Community is very important and a very familiar theme in your work, in your writings, John. And this novel does get there eventually. But I said in the opening to the programme tonight, I said that John McGregor gives us derring do in Antarctica in his new novel, Lean, Fall, Stand. And in the opening chapter, I thought, I'm in a kind of an action thriller here. Was that part of the intention initially, at any rate?
No. Good evening, Sean. Not initially. No, it kind of took me by surprise, and I enjoyed doing something that I hadn't expected myself to do. when I first started writing about those characters in Antarctica, for some reason I was writing from a kind of distant viewpoint, and I kind of had these people remembering something that had happened years before. And it suddenly occurred to me that actually what had happened to them was kind of exciting and dramatic and had all this kind of adventure in it, and I kind of realized I could put it in the present moment and kind of live that drama.
Yeah, just maybe explain the setup, the three characters that were with in that opening section, and how it sets up where the novel goes after that.
Yeah, so there's the three characters, the older man, Doc, and the two younger colleagues, Luke and Thomas, and they're in a remote station in Antarctica. The two younger men are cartographers, doing mapping, and the older man, Doc, is a very, very experienced like field guide. He's there to kind of facilitate their work. They're landed there by plane. They're kind of hundreds of miles away from anybody else, and they're living in this tiny little hut and rubbing up against each other, often the wrong way, doing fairly mundane work in this very exciting, dramatic, glamorous setting. And when the book opens, there's a terrible storm, and all sorts of terrible stuff happens.
Yeah. Had you spent time in Antarctica yourself? Because it seems as if you're very familiar with this type of thing, these sudden storms that blow up literally in front of in people's faces, and you can barely see the hand in front of your face.
Yeah, I nearly went to Antarctica. About 17 years ago, I was on a writing residency with the British Antarctic Survey. And they took me down on a ship from the Falklands down to their main Antarctic base on the peninsula. And I was there on the ship for about 5 weeks. And in the end, the ice was too thick around the continent for the ship to get through. So I just kind of came home again. And so it's this incredibly exciting, rare, dramatic experience of kind of being there in Antarctica in the ice. But I never quite set foot on the continent itself. So it's this kind of weird... Yeah, I always hesitate to say disappointing, because that seems gratuitous, but it was very disappointing.
Yeah, so you'd like to have got the whole way there.
Exactly. Yeah. So most of what I think I know about what those characters go through has come from books and from videos and from talking to people.
Yeah, the other thing that struck me, and I don't know if I'm stretching things too far here, but the way the book opens in particular, we have these three characters literally fumbling around, trying to find ways of connecting with each other. The radio's giving them trouble. Some of them can't get their hands to the radio. Others of them, they're in difficult situations. They don't quite know how far they've been separated from each other. All of these type of things that would happen in a storm that happens really quickly and that leaves them in all that kind of difficulty. It struck me that there are similarities perhaps there to the way an author might be with the characters at the opening stages of a novel, you know, fumbling around, trying to make the connections, trying to do all those things that they're actually doing in reality in the book.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting, because the whole kind of theme of the book that kind of, so the first third of the book is set in Antarctica, and then things change, and Doc has a minor spoiler, but Doc has a stroke, and his language is affected, and that whole theme of the book being about language and communication and the difficulties of communication came out of the difficulty that I was having in writing about Antarctica. So, you know, I went on this writing residency, the Arts Council paid for it essentially, and I was expected to write a novel, and it took me 17 years because I found it really difficult to write about that experience. Yeah. I found it really difficult to put it into words. And that was what got me interested in the idea of people having difficulty with communication.
Yeah, and then the novel, as I say, or as you say there, that we have three words in the title, Lean, Fall, Stand, and we have three sections, almost like a three-act play or a three-act film in some ways, in the way it plays out. And that middle act being the difficulties that Doc has when he comes home, and indeed his family have, trying to deal with the situation that they suddenly find themselves in, a husband and father who needs care and a health system that suddenly jumps into action and takes over their lives.
Mm, yeah, yeah. And he's somebody who's always had this self-image of himself as kind of self-reliant and self-sufficient, and you know, every year he goes away to Antarctica and does his stuff, and he comes back, you know, for half the year, and they've kind of got used to him as this kind of semi-absent figure, and the marriage has kind of functioned because of his absences. You know, it's a funny relationship, kind of loving but also kind of relies on this distance, and suddenly he's back for good, and he needs his wife in a way that he never has before, and she's kind of dumped into this role as carer that she didn't really ask for, and doesn't, you know, she's not, people often think of carers in this kind of noble way, the kind of heroism of caring. And it, you know, there is something heroic about it, but it's often a kind of, you know, people don't volunteer for it. You know, people are often just kind of thrown into it, and they just have to do it, and they just get on with it.
What about the relationship with the children? Is he's two adult. Anna is the wife, and Doc and Anna have two adult children, Frank and Sarah. You know, the relationship there is quite difficult. Again, this idea of communication all the time. How do they communicate with each other? When Doc has difficulties, there's an extra layer added onto it. But there are communication difficulties within the family anyway.
Yeah, and I think that was what I became really interested in. Well, when I was researching this condition called aphasia, which some people get after a stroke or after a brain injury of some kind, you know, which is very kind of specific medical deficits in the ability to produce language or comprehend language, and the more I looked into it, I kind of found echoes in the ways we all struggle with language, you know, and the way that we often use phrases like "that's not quite what I meant," or "that I can't quite think how to explain it. I'm not sure how to describe it." You know, we say these things all the time because language is always a little bit inadequate, and often the fractures in relationships and the fractures in families are caused by people not quite finding the right words or not being able to hear each other when they have found the right words, and so there are problems with communication throughout the relationships in these characters, not just the kind of what's caused by the aphasia.
The section of the novel then that in some ways I found myself laughing quite a bit when we got to the third, which I presume was the intention on your part, because while, yes, of course, what happens in the third part, essentially, we see Doc becoming part of an experimental therapy group, and we meet others in situations similar to his in this therapy group. And yes, some of the situations are tragic and awful and frustrating, particularly for those who are trying to break through with their communication. But they're also sometimes incredibly funny. I presume that was part of your intention, John.
Yeah, it was. And that was one of the things I learned really quickly when I went to a group in Nottingham, kind of a self-help group for people with aphasia and their carers, their partners. And you know, they weren't doing anything as quite as adventurous as the group in the book does. There was no dancing, but there was a bit of singing, and there were quizzes and a lot of biscuits and just kind of chat. You know, these are people who can't really talk, getting together once a month to try and chat. And it was a really moving experience. So really, you know, they really welcomed me into the group. I was really clear about being there to want to learn about their situations. And what I quickly learned was they have a lot of fun. You know, they are struggling often, and there was a lot of frustration, and sometimes people would get upset about not being able to get their meaning across, but often they would just be laughing at I mean, just having a laugh anyway, but also having a laugh at the muddle that was happening with their communication. And I kind of think it's the same with a lot of things. When somebody's in a situation, has a condition or a thing that they're living with, they don't spend all their time kind of being conscious of the thing. They just that's part of their life now, and they try and get on with the rest of their life, and that's really important.
So in some ways, from what I'm saying about the characters at the beginning and right through this aphasia section and then this therapy section towards the end, it is a metaphor for the writing of a book, or I suppose writing of any kind, really, that we get here in some ways.
Yeah. I mean, it's a metaphor for what writing... I mean, writing as language and, you know, the limits of language and what language is always attempting. You know, language is attempting to reach other people. Language is attempting to give your experience to somebody else. And language almost always fails to do that. And you know, and that's, you know, novels and stories are always trying to give somebody else an experience and usually falling a little bit short. But that's part of the kind of the joy of it, you know, is in the attempt.
Well, congratulations on the attempt that you have in this novel. Thanks for speaking to us this evening, John.
Thank you, Sean.
That's John McGregor, and his new novel, Lean Falls Stand, is published by Fourth Estate. And John will be appearing at the 2021 International Literature Festival in Dublin. He'll be in conversation with Keith Ridgway and our own Paula Shields. That's at 6 p.m. on Saturday, the 29th of May. And you can find out full details at ilfdublin.com. This week on Arena, we've been featuring the finalists in the 2021 Moth Poetry Prize. We've already heard from New York poet Suzanne Cleary and the Oxford-based Roland Bagnall. Tonight, it's the turn of a poet from Cardiff, Abigail Parry.
In the dream of the cold restaurant, the man with the buttonhole and broad lapels is folding and refolding a white napkin. Look, say his hands at intervals. A swan. A dancing girl. An intricate scale model of the Mourne Library on Chancery Lane. The man adjusts his buttonhole and coughs as each one fails, precisely, to entertain. A waitress intervenes, bringing two plates. Fluted. Plain. Translucent. And quite empty, such is the gaunt extravagance of dreams.
Abigail Parry there and her poem In the Dream of the Cold Restaurant. And Abigail is one of the finalists in this year's Moth Poetry Prize. We'll have more from the prize, including the announcement of the winner, on tomorrow night's programme. RTE National Symphony Orchestra Live continues over the next two Friday nights with live concerts streamed from the National Concert Hall on RTE.ie and broadcast simultaneously on RTE Lyric FM. In the second of the two concerts on Friday week, Finian Collins will perform and direct from the piano with a programme that includes music by Haydn and Mozart. And Finian joins me on the programme this evening. Haydn and Mozart, the two composers that you'll be treating here, among the two composers that you'll be treating here, and you're directing from the piano. Is there something specifically about, we're talking this particular period in musical history, is there something about that period, Finian, that makes directing from the piano much more possible than it might be in other types of music?
Absolutely, Sean, and good evening. Yes, and there is, because the orchestra wasn't as big as it became later in the 19th century. In fact, the position of conductor hadn't really been invented back in the late 18th century. It wouldn't have been dreamt of. So the Mozart and Haydn and all the other people rocking around Vienna at the time would have not thought twice about sitting down and directing the piece from the keyboard. That would have been, in fact, their only option. So this is by far the most authentic way to perform these pieces, and it's a joy to do so.
Yeah, and that idea, I suppose, it's yes, we are talking about an orchestra in this case, and it kind of suits the current situation we're in, where forces are such that the orchestra members, the members have to be spaced out, you know, they obviously have to be socially distanced on stage, et cetera, et cetera. So those smaller forces work for music like this, for certain, but it gives it a kind of a, is there more of a chamber music feel to it, the kind of communication that might be there in a string quartet, or maybe bigger forces like an octet or something like that?
Yes, absolutely. I always say it's like playing chamber music on a large scale. And the fact that there isn't a conductor standing there between the orchestra and the soloist means, in fact, that each player in the orchestra really has to listen very carefully to the piano, because I won't be there to bring each entry in. I'll be playing my part as well. So they really have to take extra responsibility. And it means that they really listen. Everybody's listening to each other. It's a joint effort. And it kind of breaks down the traditional hierarchy, if you like, of orchestra, conductor, soloist. It just brings us all together into one kind of holistic approach to the interpretation of the pieces.
When did the idea of the conductor then, when did it come into play, and when did it take over, if you like?
Well, I think as the orchestra got bigger and concertos, you know, if you were trying to play, and I know it has been done by many people, Barry Douglas included, but you know, if you're trying to play the Brahms piano concertos and it's very big orchestral parts, and then you're also trying to direct, I mean, I really think that it just became very, very difficult, and pieces became more difficult. So as the 19th century rolled on, piano concertos and other concertos would have had the two separate
the conductor roles and the soloist.
Very, very much defined. Yeah, exactly.
All right, let's have a listen then to a section from one of the pieces you'll be playing on Friday week, the Mozart Piano Concerto Number 9, Jeune Homme, Young Man. Here, you know, the temptation here is to think of the Jeune Homme. Mozart, I think, was barely 21 at this stage. It's to think that it's him that this piece is about, but it was somebody else he was referring to in that title.
Yes, in fact, Jeune Homme is sort of frowned upon these days as the title of the piece, because it's sort of fallacious and it was something added in the 20th century. It was dedicated to a lady by the name of Victoire Jeune-Ami, and somehow Jeune Homme got mixed up with that, and people thought, well, he wrote it as a young man and call it the Jeune Homme Concerto, which is very nice, but it's more appropriately known as the Jeune-Ami Concerto. But it is an absolute masterpiece for a man of 21, as we might hear now in this extract.
Yeah, and this extract features yourself playing, in fact, from a recording with the RTÉ National Symphony Orchestra, November the 5th, 2010, and you're directing from the piano stool once again in this piece. Let's have a listen. That is the opening section from the first movement of Mozart's Piano Concerto Number 9 in E flat major. Finian Collins, the soloist, there with the National Concert with the RTÉ National Symphony Orchestra in the National Concert Hall back in 2010, and he'll be reprising that piece on Friday week as part of the RTÉ NSO Live series, which is continuing. And once again, he'll be directing from the piano stool when it comes to that. You put this the Jeune Homme, I'll call it that, since you're telling me that's actually how it should be referred to, Concerto Finian, alongside a Haydn piano concerto. How do the two pieces speak to each other for you?
Well, they're similar in many ways. They have to use the same forces. They both have strings and oboes and horns only, so they work very well for COVID, because you don't need lots and lots of musicians on the restricted stage of the National Concert Hall. They were written within 5-6 years of each other. The Haydn was written in the after the Mozart. It's Haydn's last concerto. It's his 11th concerto in D major, and the Haydn concertos aren't as well known generally as the Mozart. This one is the one that's played the most. It's very, very immediately attractive. It's got great wit and joy about it, and a sort of a gypsy Hungarian rondo finale. So I think, you know, I think they work well together as pieces. They're clearly from the same period, and Mozart was without doubt, you know, influenced by Haydn, and there are lots of parallels between them. But you'd have to say the Haydn is a more slight piece. Mm. The Mozart is extraordinary in the sense that, as I said, he was only 21. It has this wonderfully dark, tragic second movement, and in the third movement, he brings in most unexpectedly a sort of a minuet in A flat major in the middle of the last movement, Rondo. So Mozart really, you know, really setting out his stall here as somebody of extraordinary talent. Even at the very beginning of the concerto, which we heard in that extract, we immediately brings in the soloist replying to the orchestra, which was a new thing then. So really, really setting new standards for himself and for composers everywhere. But the Haydn is not to be discounted in any way in relation to the Mozart. It's an absolutely beautiful piece with very light orchestration and, you know, a lot of bits where you just have to say the piano and the violins talking to each other, and then you might have the violas joining in, and it's very, very light textured in that way, and very it's short and crisp and immediately attractive.
Yeah, I want to play a little section from the third movement, in fact. This doesn't feature you. It featured a pianist called Alexandre Thoreau. Just listen to the speed he starts out the third movement at. Now, I don't think that Alexandre Thoreau was in a rush home the night he was performing that, but that is breakneck pace.
Well, maybe he just drank lots of coffee before he started.
Will you be at that speed when it comes to it on Friday week, or is that a little fast for your taste, Vinny?
It's very quick. Yes, it is very, very quick. But you know, the adrenaline flowing in the body, and you're excited. Now, you know, there won't be 1,200 people sitting in the audience, which often adds to the temperature and can lead to things such as quick tempos becoming quicker. But yeah, I mean, it's a vivacious piece, and I think at any tempo it'll be exciting.
Yeah, because you also get in the midst of that those little crushed notes and accented notes, which it is that wit that Haydn could bring, like he has in his Joke Symphony, you know, where the Surprise Symphony as well, where you get the sudden loud chord. He knew how to play those kind of musical jokes.
Oh, he was, and he was a master of wit. I mean, there's so many jokes throughout his many, many string quartets and in his piano sonatas too, and he was so able to stop and start and do unexpected things. And later on in the same movement of the Haydn, of the piano concerto, you know, he goes into D minor and starts poking fun, and then later on sets the piano off in another direction into a sort of a B minor episode, which is sort of mock passionate, and he's all the time having fun, you know, and it's just very, very appealing.
Yeah, and you mentioned there, Finian, that of course there won't be an audience in the concert hall itself, but it will be live streamed on rte.ie/culture and indeed broadcast live on RTE Lyric FM. The absence of an audience maybe prevents the kind of, as you talked about, the adrenaline that leads to fast paces becoming even faster. What do you really miss most about not having an audience there?
Well, it is that sense of occasion, I suppose, really, of excitement. It's particularly difficult when you're on your own and performing a solo recital. I think the nice thing about this next week will be that I'll have all the musicians of the orchestra on stage with me. So in a way, we play to each other, we bounce off each other, which will be great. You know, it'll make up, I suppose, in some way, to not having 1,000 people there in expectation and adding to the energy of the evening. But you know, you make do. It's a bit like making a television program, I suppose, or a CD recording, where you just have to rise to the occasion. And you know, you do play. I've done quite a number of live streams now. In fact, I did a little last night for Music for Galway. And you know, you play for the people who are at home watching, and you in your mind you channel the energy that they bring, and they're sitting there looking at their screens and they're agog, and you do your best to sort of, of course it's not the same, but you do your best to sort of to play to those people.
But it is live, and therefore you can't say, do you know what, we'll take it from the beginning again. You can't do that type of thing.
And the live stream definitely brings that extra level of excitement compared to a pre-recorded concert. It's really in the moment, and you carry on, and that's wonderful.
All right. Well, listen, best of luck with it all, and thanks for being with us this evening there. That's pianist Finian Collins, who will perform and direct from the piano with the RTÉ National Symphony Orchestra Friday, May the 7th at the National Concert Hall, music of Mozart and Haydn. This Friday, April the 30th, will feature a programme of music, the third suite from Respighi's Ancient Airs and Dances, and also Pelléas and Melisande, piece by Jean Sibelius. And that is this Friday, April the 30th. There will be a conductor there. It will be none other than Prontius O'Dwin. And both concerts are part of the ongoing RTÉ National Symphony Orchestra live series, streamed live from the National Concert Hall, rte.ie/culture, broadcast live on RTÉ Lyric FM. Full details on rte.ie/NSO. First Cut Youth Film Festival is based in Youghal and is dedicated to showcasing new films by young people. It also gives budding filmmakers an opportunity to learn new skills from and make connections with more established filmmakers. This year, First Cut Youth Film Festival has gone online and is offering a whole range of workshops for the young filmmaker, such as a screenwriting masterclass or a workshop on using archives in filmmaking. Then, of course, just like Cannes or Venice or any other festival, First Cut has the festival competition where best film, director and animation will be announced. From the menu, we picked a workshop on advice for young people who want to get into making films or television programmes, be it as an actor, a director, a scriptwriter, key grip, focus putter, whatever role it is that they want to play. And joining me this evening are two established practitioners in the field, director and screenwriter Ciara Hyland and presenter of the Homeschool Hub on RTÉ TV, Ray Cudahy, who will be taking part in the Getting Into TV panel discussion, which takes place on Saturday as part of First Cut. And great to have Ciara and Ray with us this evening. Before we get into the specifics of how you actually got into the whole television production area, tell us, Ciara, maybe you tell us a little bit about some of the work you've been doing in recent years. I was particularly taken, I have to say, by your series Cogo Evernaw, the War on Women, the T.G. Carr and RTÉ series that was broadcast quite recently.
Oh, hi, Sean. Thanks for having us on. Yeah, Cougar Vanoa was a joint production between RTÉ and T.G. Cahir, and it was about the hidden stories of sexual violence that had happened during the Irish Revolution. It was a real, I suppose, labour of love for us. You know, it was very close to our hearts because we came across letters and diaries and, you know, I suppose, written testimony that many of these women had left behind but had never, you know, received justice or even, I suppose, been heard in, you know, in public, or it had never really been acknowledged that that kind of stuff had actually been part of the Irish Revolution. And so it was a real privilege and an honour to recreate those stories using those women's own words and bring them to a general public for the first time.
Did that grow out of, in some ways, Ciara, did it grow out of some of the other work you've been doing around the whole revolutionary period? First of all, 74 days inside Terence McSweeney's hunger strike, that also for RTÉ, and in 2019 you wrote and directed a two-part series for T.G. Cahir, Devil Era in America, maybe slightly later than the revolutionary period. But does one project often beget another in that fashion?
They do, absolutely, absolutely. And I think what happens is, I love history. I absolutely adore history. And I think once you start, like, I suppose, reading some of the research that's happening at the moment, we have a very vibrant, lively history community in Ireland with a lot of very great cutting-edge research being done and some really outstanding academics. And I think once you start to sort of get to know them and you start to, you know, read some of their work and then you start to have chats with them, and then you kind of slowly uncover just the kind of amazing stuff that's happening. And Cougar Vanaugh grew out of some of the cutting edge research that that some of the academics or some of the historians in Ireland had been doing to uncover those stories, you know. Yeah. So like, we didn't actually uncover those stories, the historians had done that work. We just brought them to the greater public.
Yeah, but it's about, I suppose, television is all about, how do you bring the story that's a part of history, yeah, in a book or whatever else, how do you bring it to the screen, how do you make it happen? But let's before we move off Cogar Vanaugh, because as I said, it certainly bits that I saw really impressed me, and the stories were very upsetting, and
they were, yeah.
kind of history that we hadn't heard. We certainly weren't taught it at school, that's for sure. I want to play a clip, and it really deals directly with this sexual violence during the revolutionary period. It's from the opening of the series. Very graphic description, I should warn people, of sexual violence towards the end of this clip from Cogar Vernon.
During the political trouble, when looting and robbing and raiding were carried on to such an extent in our country district, my trouble began. In January 1923, a party of men armed to the teeth and calling themselves Republicans forced their entrance into our house. The object of their visit was money or lives. And they were furious when they did not get money. One brute satisfied his duty passion on me. I was then in a dangerous state of health, and through his conduct, I became pregnant. Oh God, could any pen describe what I have gone through?
Very powerful clip there from the docudrama Cogar Vernon. And with me this evening is Ciara Hyland, who was involved in that project, obviously, and Ray Cudahy. They're here to speak to us about First Cut Youth Film Festival. I'll come back to you, Ciara, because what we just played is obviously when things had moved on and you'd established a career to a certain extent. But let's go to Ray at this point and talk to you, Ray, about how are you doing? Good to have you on the programme again.
How are you, Sean? How's it going?
Not bad at all. Now, you've worked on television as an actor. You've been a puppeteer, resident puppeteer in RTE. You've also you've written script. You've worked at lots of aspects of television. How did you start? How did the television aspect of things start out for you, Ray?
Well, I actually kind of fell into television in the sense that I was mainly obsessed with radio, actually, and I still work in radio as well. But I went to Connemara to improve my Irish. I did a part-time drama course there. And of course, in Galway, there's always kind of funky, weird and cool things going on. So there was loads of puppets hanging on the walls in Galway, and in this theatre in Galway, in Sheldon Skull, Salerna, out in Indrevon. And I started picking up puppets, and next thing myself and my buddy started writing some sketches for puppets and stuff like that. Then eventually I started doing some tours and theatre work and stuff like that. And then eventually we made a TV show for TG Cahir. So it was Puppets in the Air, and absolutely flew off from there. Then after a while, then RTE called and I jumped in with RTE Junior and stuff like that. So very different to what Ciara does. Mm. But yeah, but super creative, and I love it. I love it. Yeah. So then puppeteering, and then eventually during the Homeschool Hub era, I actually jumped up from under the table and I stood up for the first time on TV, you could say.
All right. Yeah, well, you did a little few. You'd certainly had appearances on RTE Junior along the way. I've watched you there as well at certain points. But the teaching side of things, did you qualify as a teacher alongside all of the performance work, Ray, or was just that you were interested in education and that was what made you a great choice, it has to be said, yourself and the others for the RTE school, the Homeschool Hub?
Yeah, well, I kind of, you see, I suppose, you know, as you're kind of progressing through age, you're kind of thinking to yourself, like, oh, how long is this puppeteering thing gonna last? Like, you know what I mean? So I went back and I studied in Mary Eye. I did the master's there. But I wasn't long teaching. I only qualified in 2019. So I was only teaching a couple of months before Homeschool Hub started. So I was still finding my feet and still subbing and stuff like that. And when the crunch came last March, and so then, yeah, I was able to jump into that, but very much brought the skills from TV and all that communication skills. Yeah. Like, I was used to bringing that into the classroom anyway. And then when there was the opportunity to go the other way and bring the skills from the classroom and put them on the TV screen, I was very confident that they'd work, you know.
Yeah.
I was I just knew by the kind of the visualness of it, and even the kind of the normality of, like, you know, like a human being standing in front of a whiteboard. Like, I was just like, this works. This communication will work on TV, and the slow rhythm of it will make unique television. You know what I mean? So, yeah, I was very confident it would work, and it translated extraordinarily well, really.
You must be a real celebrity sub, though, if you're still subbing around in schools when Muncho Ray appears at the door. I'm sure there's great excitement in classrooms.
The novelty wears off very quick. Yeah. I'll put it to you like that. They get used to it very quick. You know?
20 past nine. 20 past open exactly, your maths books. Exactly. It's not Muncho Ray on the telly anymore, is it? At any rate, Ciara, let me come back to you then and talk about your own start. As I said, The Cougar of an Awe and some of the other series that we've been speaking about there, very much when you had found a niche for yourself and found a place for yourself. How did you get to that place?
I studied film and TV in Dublin, and when I graduated, I was just desperate to work in film, and I just wanted to get onto film sets any way I could, really. And I basically asked people, you know, what is the best way to do this? And they said to me, well, there's two jobs nobody ever wants to do. And the first one is sound, and the other one is script supervising. And there were marginally more people doing sound than there were script supervising. So I went and I got the list. There was like about seven women working in script supervising in Ireland at the time. And I rang every single one of them up and I said, will you meet me for coffee or for lunch, or I'll buy you a sticky bun? And will you let me pick your brains, basically? And they did, in fairness, like I'd say half of them came back to me and, you know, met me for coffee. I was very young at the time, I was only like 21. They let me pick their brains. They were really kind to me, really supportive. And then I basically plagued them for the next couple of months, rang them up every couple of weeks and said, have you anything that you could take me on, even for unpaid work experience to get me out on set, or you know, if anything, a traineeship comes up or whatever. And that's basically how it started. And it kind of snowballed from there, and it was brilliant. Like it was, I just owe so much to those women. Like that gave me my start. So
yeah, and I suppose it's important to say that, because you got to remember that those women and lots of people who currently work in television or in radio or in film or whatever it is, they had to start out once upon a time as well. So they know the sort of things that you're worried about and the sort of things that you're trying to go through. But Ray, Ciara, interesting there in how I'm sure the sticky bun. was part of what got her there, but you do have to persevere. You do have to without plaguing people, you do have to ring up and you have to keep yourself informed about what's happening.
Absolutely. But I suppose like the thing that you got to remember is that like in any creative industry, you got people working with passion, you know what I mean? So first of all, that passion is going to drive young people to reach out to people, and it'll work the other way as well. The Uncle Tom or whoever it is that you're connecting with, like they're going to be mad to talk shop as well. You know what I mean? So and because like film and TV is a genuinely really exciting industry to work in. Like I talk about puppets all day for you. You know what I mean? And like I mean, and plus as well, like I've been puppeteering for many years, but I'm still reaching out to puppeteers, you know what I mean? And not just in Ireland, in the UK as well, like, you know what I mean? Because I'm really keen and I'm genuinely interested in what they're doing, you know what I mean? So, so yeah, with this panel that we did now for First Cut Film Festival, it was really just like, it was just a bunch of people who are genuinely excited about film and TV. Yeah. And I suppose like, and what the festival is doing is really harnessing that energy of young people getting into the industry as well, because they're immediately our colleagues and we immediately want to share, you know, our experiences with them as well as them looking for experience.
I think it's interesting too that both of you have mentioned TG Cathair along the way. And TG Cathair, of course, I mean, a relatively young television station, but the Sulela aspect of it, you know, this other eye, looking at things in a different way, it kind of it's a good guideline for any form of even online activity that you might be interested in doing, Ciara, to get your own vision and go with that.
Oh, completely, completely. Like TG Cathair, the very first thing I ever directed actually was TG Cathair taking a punt on me. And yeah, they are very good. They are very good at, I suppose, looking at things slightly differently and taking that bit of a chance on new talent, because it is a bit of a chance to give somebody who's never directed before a budget and to let them off at it, you know. So, but yeah, I mean, like back to what Ray said, I mean, our panel discussion was just great. We had such a ball. It was such fun actually to to just talk shop with Ray and with the other people on the panel. But, you know, one of the things that came out of it was that idea that that nowadays you've got YouTube, you know, like where you actually can just shoot stuff on your phone and keep shooting and shoot with your mates and put it up on YouTube and put it into festivals like the First Cut Film Festival and get an audience feedback. And that actually that's something we didn't have when we were younger, you know, and it's kind of amazing that this generation has that
Sure. Listen, lovely. Míle Buíochas don Bhearcach anocht. Thanks very much for speaking to us. Ciara Hyland and Ray Cuddihy. Go raibh maith agat, go raibh freisin. And the session, Getting Started on TV panel, the panel discussion, it's on Saturday, this coming Saturday at 7:30 p.m. First Cut Youth Film Festival, up and running at the moment, continues through until May the 9th. And you can connect with First Cut at firstcutfilmfestival.com. That is our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy, Paula Shields researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Mark McGrath was on sound. And tonight's programme was produced by Keishi. Talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, once again here on RT Radio 1.